ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What do Rasputin, Tupac, and Pharaoh Ramses III have in common? No, it's not the weirdest boy band ever. They all met their end at the hand of an assassin. From seizing power to silencing dissidents, Assassins unpacks the moments in which someone decides that murder is the move. Search for Assassins with Aslan Pahari on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National, leading the national conversation of legal stories and cases. The implied freedom of political communication has been at the centre of several recent high-profile court decisions. One involves pro-Palestine protests in Sydney, another the denial of an entry visa to a controversial far-right US commentator. Legal experts are also suggesting free speech arguments could be raised in a potential challenge to Australia's social media ban for children. I'm joined by Professor Luke McNamara and Associate Professor Daniel Joyce. They're both based at the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. Daniel, do we have a right to free speech in Australia, and what form does it take?
Well, thanks, Damien. People often think that we do have a right to free speech, but of course we don't actually have a Bill of Rights within the Australian Constitution. And so there are a variety of forms for protection for speech, most notably what is termed the implied freedom of political communication. But it is not a personal right. It is not like the US First Amendment right. Rather, it is a constitutional implication that's seen as being necessary to protect our system of representative and responsible government. So it essentially operates systemically. It limits legislative and executive power rather than kind of providing an avenue for someone to go to the courts and say, my right to free speech has been imperiled. And what it does also systemically is protect the free flow of information that is seen as being necessary in our democracy.
So there's nothing in our constitution which says Australians have freedom of speech, unlike, say, the US Constitution or even maybe the Human Rights Act in the UK or other places.
That's correct. And we're quite unusual in that regard.
Okay. So what do you need to establish or successfully run an argument that an implied freedom to political communication has been infringed?
There is a test that's evolved in the case law. The earlier cases from in the early 90s developed a test that essentially is about balancing the different interests involved. And so in the famous case of Longy, that test was stated, does the impugned law burden the implied freedom of political communication? So is the law that is seen as problematic in terms of speech or communication, is that something that is burdening or affecting or practically impacting political communication? And then secondly, if it is that law reasonably appropriate and adapted to achieving a legitimate end in a manner compatible with the system of government that we have in Australia? Now, over time, that's evolved into a three-part test.
And so is it fair to say that the third part of the test is the law reasonably appropriate and adapted to advance a legitimate object which is consistent with this idea of maintaining a constitutionally prescribed system of representative government?
Exactly. So when you're essentially balancing the purposes and objects of both the need for the implied freedom on the one hand, but then also whatever the purpose of the law that is in kind of dispute is, there needs to actually be some kind of balancing of that. And that often happens in the sort of second and third parts of the test.
Okay, so we've just seen this implied freedom of political communication being argued in a number of high-profile cases. Luke, if I can bring you in here, there was a case in the New South Wales Supreme Court, Lees and the State of New South Wales, that was around the right to protest. What was the issue at the heart of that case?
The issue in this case was a new law that the New South Wales Parliament had enacted to provide police with greater powers to move on protesters if they were adjacent to a place of worship. So this was a matter that was taken by Joshua Lees, one of the organisers of the Palestine Action Group, which has been organising Palestinian solidarity protests for 2 years now on a regular basis. And this action was taken because the concern of the plaintiff was that this particular adjustment to the pre-existing move-on powers that the police already had at their disposal went too far. It interrupted the right to protest in ways that were inappropriate, and it did so in a way that was inconsistent with the implied freedom of political communication.
So under this legislation, which was brought in earlier this year, a demonstrator could be moved on if the demonstration didn't have a permit and it was occurring in or near a place of worship.
That's correct. And in order to understand the significance of that law and this decision, it's really important to understand the backstory of the move-on power. Now, police have been dispersing crowds, moving on individuals for as long as there's been organised policing. But it wasn't until the late 1990s in New South Wales that the Parliament decided to formalise the power of police officers to move on individuals or groups. And that was really at the time around concerns about antisocial behaviour. And so the thresholds for the police being lawfully entitled to move on individuals and groups was around whether they were assessed to be at risk of obstructing other people in public places, harassing, intimidating, causing fear in others. So a pretty broad discretion, but for a particular purpose. And most importantly in this context, a key feature of the original move-on power, which is now found in the Law Enforcement Powers and Responsibilities Act, or LEPRA, is that there was an absolute prohibition on the police using move-on powers against public assemblies, against industrial action, against public protest. And that was really set firmly and explicitly in the legislation. And what we saw in this case was a response to a move by Parliament to erode that protection. So what the legislation had done was to empower the police to move on protesters if the police assessed that they were at risk of obstructing, etc., and they were in proximity to a place of worship.
So the context for the adoption of these amendments by the New South Wales state government early this year was sort of a rise in anti-Semitic attacks and incidents around the state and concerns around protecting that community. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. So it was in the context of the genuine concerns of the community, of government, around a rise in anti-Semitic incidents. And then that focused particularly on the prospect of protests being conducted in the vicinity of synagogues. And so this legislation was enacted in that context. And of course, the legislation is struck in more general terms. It addresses places of worship rather than Jewish synagogues specifically. But that certainly was the context in which this occurred. And the legislation did two things. In addition to modifying the police move-on powers, it created new offences, or a new offence in particular. So it became an offence to intentionally impede worshippers from accessing a place of worship, or harassing or intimidating worshippers on their way to or from a place of worship. And that criminal offence is new, but it wasn't at issue in this case. There was no objection taken to the existence of that offence. The objection was taken to the move-on powers that were modified and which expanded the capacity of the police to move on protesters without need to prove that they were interrupting or interfering with worshippers accessing their place of worship. And that was a critical issue in this case. Justice Mitchell Moore had to interpret the legislation, and her interpretation was that this legislation authorised the police to move on protesters without any reason to be satisfied or even to inquire as to whether or not the interruption that was being caused was to worshippers. And that was where the legislation came unstuck in light of the implied freedom of political communication.
Luke, how did Justice Mitchell Moore of the New South Wales Supreme Court apply the three-part test that Daniel spoke about before to this piece of legislation?
So the first thing that the judge did was to assess whether or not there was a burden imposed by this new provision on the implied freedom of communication. And that was easily answered in the affirmative. Yes, there was a burden. The second question was, did this legislation pursue a legitimate purpose? Again, in terms of protecting the Jewish community and people of faith generally, it was pretty easy to establish that there was a legitimate purpose behind this legislation. But the third question was the critical one. Was this law reasonably appropriate and adapted to advance that legitimate purpose? And here is where Her Honour formed the view that the legislation went further than was necessary. And so one of the ways in which judges make this assessment as to reasonable appropriateness is whether or not the legitimate objective could have been achieved by a less burdensome means. And in this instance, the decision really turns on the fact that Parliament could have enacted a law which required the police to first make an assessment that worshippers were being intimidated or harassed or impeded before this capacity to use move-on powers against protesters was enlivened. That wasn't a requirement of the legislation as Justice Mitchell Moore interpreted it, and that was the overreach.
So the argument of the Palestine Action Group was that everywhere in central Sydney is close to a place of worship, including, you know, Town Hall Square and Hyde Park, which are sort of traditional places of a protest. So this law could effectively leave demonstrators at risk of being charged if they refused to move on, if they were asked to do so by the police. Was that the crux of what we're talking about here?
That is the essence of it. And I think it was quite an effective strategy for the plaintiffs in this case to put before the court information about where protests are regularly held in Sydney, including, as you say, near the Town Hall, at the north end of Hyde Park. And indeed, the Palestine Action Group had been conducting weekly peaceful protests in the Hyde Park location for the last 2 years. And so, yes, what was at issue here was if police were authorised to give a move-on direction simply because protesters were proximate to, for example, St. Mary's Cathedral, that would seriously erode the right to protest in this situation. So it's a non-criminal measure, a move-on power, but if a person doesn't comply with a move-on direction, they have committed an offence. And so this was a very important decision from the point of view of recognising that there need to be very tight constraints on the capacity of the police to use move-on powers against protesters.
And section 214B of the Crimes Act states, a person in or near a place of worship must not intentionally block, impede or hinder a person accessing or leaving a place of worship, or harass, intimidate or threaten a person accessing or leaving a place of worship. That criminal offence, of course, still stands, but the move-on power, where a protester walking past or near a place of worship can be instructed by police to move on, that's the subject of this decision.
That's correct. And I think it's important to recognise that there is a qualitative difference between the threshold set by the criminal offence, for which you've just read out the definition, and the much looser discretion-based authority which the legislation purported to give police in relation to move-on powers. And it reminds us that move-on powers are a dimension of police powers that are really underappreciated. They're largely conducted in circumstances where there's no visibility, there's no monitoring. Now, protest contexts change that, of course, because protesters are vigilant, media are present, and so there's a greater awareness of what police are doing. But it was really important in this case that the court had the opportunity to scrutinise this latest attempt to limit the ways in which people can lawfully conduct protest.
And the judge said, quote, what is significant about section 214B for present purposes is that it is squarely directed at the rights and interests of the persons whom the legislation was intended to protect, rather than relying on proximity to a place as a proxy for the rights and interests of those persons, end quote. So that sort of sums it up.
Yes.
The implied freedom of political communication is the topic of the Law Report this week on ABC Radio National. And my guests are Professor Luke McNamara and Associate Professor Daniel Joyce, both based at UNSW. Daniel, if I can come to you, the High Court of Australia recently handed down a decision also looking at this implied freedom. It involves a US conservative right-wing commentator or influencer or podcaster. Her name's Candace Owens Farmer. Who is she?
So Candace Owens Farmer is, as you've said, a right-wing commentator who was seeking at the end of 2024 to come to Australia on a speaking tour to talk about a range of controversial topics. She's got a track record of speaking on a range of issues that have caused concerns for the Minister for Home Affairs. And particularly the minister's key concerns were her views regarding Holocaust denial, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, her criticisms of the Black Lives Matter movement, her views on women's and LGBTQIA plus rights, and her anti-vax views as well. So because of those concerns, Minister Burke, the Minister for Home Affairs, relied on a provision of the Migration Act to refuse to grant Owens Farmer a visa, a temporary activity visa, to conduct that speaking tour, and she wasn't able to come to Australia.
So I think it was under Section 503(1) of the Migration Act, the minister refused to grant Ms. Farmer a visa because, she failed what could be termed a character test.
Yes.
And I think he said, quote, she would incite discord in the Australian community or a segment of that community. So she challenged this legislation, saying that this Section 503 impinged on her implied freedom of political communication. But the High Court of Australia unanimously found that argument was not going to fly. What did it find?
There were different judgments, but essentially the High Court found unanimously that Candace Owens Farmer could not rely on the implied freedom of political communication to essentially invalidate the relevant section of the Migration Act, which allows the minister to refuse to grant visas on character grounds and in the national interest. So broadly, the object of the Act was seen as being to regulate in the national interest non-citizens coming to or remaining in Australia. But the particular provisions in Section 501, which relate to the refusal on character grounds, those were seen as having a protective purpose in relation to concerns that she would incite discord in the Australian community, or at least incite discord in a segment of the Australian community. And this was clearly said not to be about merely disagreement or whether she would cause offence through her views, though clearly she has on earlier occasions offended many, and not just in Australia. The real issue here that the minister needed to establish was that there would be a material risk that she would incite discord in the Australian community. So even though broadly this case was about rising concerns regarding social cohesion, the court particularly focused on the concerns that the minister had and was, I think, happy to see that the minister had taken into account the views of our security agencies regarding the rise in extremism, their views in relation to the connection between hate speech, incitement and actual violence, and concerns about Owens Farmer's misinformation activities and the fact that her tour could constitute a material risk of harm for the Australian community.
Have there been other people who have been denied visas on these character grounds? How often does that happen, Daniel?
Look, it does happen from time to time, and I think the minister has indicated in a number of recent cases that because of concerns about the rise in extremism and because of concerns about social cohesion, there is sort of particular attention in this area. So we've seen this year the revocation of a visa of a far-right Israeli MP, Simcha Rothman, and that resulted in Israel retaliating by cancelling visas for Australia's representatives to the Palestinian Authority, and also the musician Kanye West, who has family connections to Australia, was denied a visa to come on character grounds, principally because of his anti-Semitism, and the evidence there pointed to was a recent song of his that referenced Adolf Hitler.
Mm. Interestingly, along those lines, a white supremacist, Jacob Hursant, was in the county court in Melbourne last week appealing a one-month jail sentence for performing a Nazi salute in public. I think he was the first person convicted under relatively recent Victorian laws banning Nazi salutes in public. I understand that one of his arguments in the appeal is this implied freedom of political communication. Can I get your views about whether or not that kind of argument, how courts might receive that kind of argument for that kind of action?
Well, I think that actually, even though we've been focusing on some cases where the implied freedom arguments have been successful in the protest context, in some ways, the Owens Farmer case is a more typical case where even though there may be some burden on speech, often there's a fairly poor track record for these challenges. And I do think, obviously it's speculative, but I do think that it is unlikely such an argument would succeed. There have been similar challenges to vilification laws, which have been found to be legitimate and appropriate and adapted in the relevant ways. And so I find it hard to see that a white supremacist would be able to characterise hate speech as freedom of political communication in this context, and that really significantly that there wouldn't be a legitimate purpose in the laws that have resulted in his conviction.
Luke, I know you have a very strong interest in vilification and hate speech. So how might that three-point test be applied in this scenario?
Look, I think it's pretty clear that a court is very likely to interpret a ban on the Nazi salute as something that does burden political expression, no doubt. But it's equally clear, in my view, that the courts are likely to regard such an imposition as an entirely legitimate purpose. And as to the question of whether or not such a law is reasonably appropriate and adapted to advancing that legitimate purpose, my assessment would be that the court would say, yes, it is indeed legitimate. I mean, I think it's important to recognise that we now have three decades of history of governments and parliaments carefully calibrating laws around racism in particular and other forms of hate speech. And even though we've seen a flurry of activity in recent years, including the introduction of new offences around the Nazi salute and in some instances the use of other symbols expressing extreme right-wing racism, it's important to recognise that there is a larger context of balancing competing interests. And so this is the context, I guess, where we're reminded that the implied freedom of political communication, as Daniel said earlier, is not akin to an expansive right to freedom of expression such as exists in the United States. And the US is often used as a reference point for these sorts of discussions. And what's underappreciated, I think, is that the US, in global terms, is a complete outlier. In the vast majority of countries around the world, a much more nuanced conception of the right to free speech is understood and recognised in constitutions and in law. And indeed, even though we don't have the same vehicles for protecting freedom of expression in the Australian context, that basic concept that there are acceptable limits on freedom of expression is widely understood in the Australian community, in Australian politics, and indeed in Australian law.
So that three-part test, you would say is a good thing as opposed to giving people a blanket right to say whatever they like or do whatever they like?
Indeed. It's always a misconception, I think, to regard the right to free speech as an absolute one. It's simply not. I mean, it's not even absolute in the US context, and it's absolutely not absolute in the Australian context, and nor should it be. And so I think it's entirely appropriate to recognise the need to balance different considerations. And yes, the constitutional test that the High Court has developed over time in relation to the implied freedom of communication on political matters really embodies and embeds within it that idea of balance.
I now want to pivot to a very different possible implied freedom of political communication argument. In December, Australia will start enforcing a ban on social media for those under 16. Daniel, I know you've been giving this some thought. Could there be a constitutional challenge brought by young people against this legislation?
Yes, I think there is a serious argument to be made that the teen social media ban may be unconstitutional and that it may infringe the implied freedom of political communication. Obviously, that's something that will have been anticipated by those involved in drafting the legislation and the rules creating the restrictions. But obviously, a ban on a significant section of the Australian community's ability to communicate with other members of the community, even if those under 16 cannot currently vote, that might very well be the kind of law that the courts may find involves some overreach. And so some of the arguments that we've been discussing around whether there are alternative means to achieve the objectives, obviously very important objectives, protecting young people from a range of very significant harms in relation to social media that have become more apparent, that you know, those haven't adequately been considered and that this is sort of overreach. I guess partly also there might be an argument that the law simply won't work. As a response, the government has, I think, quite cleverly targeted not young people and their parents, but the restrictions that come from the or come within Part 4 of the Online Safety Act, and which are said to reduce the risk of harm to age restricted users from certain kinds of social media platforms, obviously a very legitimate purpose, those restrictions are targeting the platforms themselves. And actually what the government has said in more recent times is that the ban will only require reasonable steps to be taken by those platforms, and so it will allow for different approaches to be taken. The government has also reiterated its commitment to the protection of children's rights under its international human rights obligations, further kind of emphasising the legitimacy of what it's trying to do. So even though I think there is quite a opportunity here for a challenge, I think we may well see that challenge ultimately being unsuccessful, because obviously it's a big thing for the courts to say, look, the government can't act in an innovative and experimental way to protect young people from the very real harms that many face, despite also the benefits that social media offers in terms of the freedom of political communication for the community at large, but for young people particularly.
So the idea would be that there probably would be consensus that this would burden political expression. The question becomes whether or not the burden is compatible with the maintenance of a constitutionally prescribed system of representative government, and the legitimate end there is the safety of kids as described by the government. And then the third question would be whether the law was reasonably appropriate or adapted to advance that legitimate object. And boy, oh boy, it might. That's where the complexity might come in.
I agree. And so as we were discussing with the Lees case and as Luke was analysing earlier, that third part of the test, particularly if a more structured and transparent form of analysis is adopted, which looks at, look, is this law a suitable vehicle? Is it the right kind of law to achieve the purpose? I think that might be an issue, and also the scale of impact might be an issue. So the fact that it affects a very large segment of the community, and also the kinds of examples that might emerge are, for example, young people who are members of the LGBTQIA plus community and who are seeking to connect with each other, climate activists, neurodiverse kids. There's many young people who rely on and benefit from social media as well. And so I think that balancing will be quite a complicated task for the courts.
In conclusion, how important is this implied freedom of political communication? Luke?
In a context where there is no statutory or constitutional foundation for the right to protest or the right of free assembly as it's recognised under international law, then it's really important that the implied freedom is available as some sort of check on the power of government to pass laws that they consider are necessary to limit the impact of protest activity, which should be regarded as a legitimate expression in a liberal democracy.
Daniel?
Look, I agree with Luke. I mean, I think many would prefer an explicit right to freedom of expression, but in the absence of a Bill of Rights, it's hard to conceive of our democracy and our constitution working without the implied freedom of political communication. And that's why I think it remains a really vitally important aspect of our constitutional framework.
Associate Professor Daniel Joyce and Professor Luke McNamara, both from the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. Thank you both for speaking to The Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
Thanks, Damien. It's been a pleasure.
That's The Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to audio producer Tim Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.